Today is National Manufacturing Day, and in our news earlier this week, we talked about the governor announcing a $2 million federal grant all to improve energy efficiency in the manufacturing sector. And I know we've been talking about the importance of just manufacturing jobs and making sure that we are not only getting people into these roles, but also maybe changing the stigma a little bit that people have still with manufacturing jobs and careers that are out there. So we have Paul Lavoie on our show pretty often. He is Connecticut's chief manufacturing officer. And unless there's an update I haven't heard, he's the only chief manufacturing officer in the country. There's no other state that has a role like this, but we have made it a priority here in Connecticut. So, Paul, welcome back to the show. I'm so glad to have you.
Well, good morning, Melissa. It's certainly great to be back on, and happy Manufacturing Day. This is the most exciting day of the year.
I know. This is like your Christmas, which is so exciting. I love seeing you so cheery. Tell me, first of all, Paul, about the manufacturing industry here in Connecticut, because it seems pretty robust.
Well, listen, we are in Connecticut. You know, we're the 48th smallest state, but when it comes to manufacturing, we punch well above our weight class. You know, there's a wide variety of manufacturers here in the state. You know, we all, I think, know about our defense manufacturing history. We are the number two state in the country in defense spending on a per capita basis. We make the machines that protect the USA sovereignty. We make submarines. We make helicopters right in Sikorsky there. We make submarines and Electric Boat. 25% of all aircraft engines are made in Connecticut. But that's not all we do. We have a great medical device manufacturing industry. And then we have this growing food and beverage industry, manufacturing industry. You know, Melissa, the world's largest organic snack factory is in Connecticut, and the world's largest non-alcoholic brewing facility is in Connecticut as well. And so there's just so much exciting things happening in the manufacturing sector with new manufacturers growing, all of our manufacturing sector growing, and again, in areas where we wouldn't necessarily think we'd have manufacturing growing. But it's an exciting time to be in manufacturing in Connecticut.
Yeah, which P.S., Electric Boat, huge deal. Is this one of their biggest contracts they just nailed with the U.S. Navy? It was in our news as well a couple days ago.
Yeah, they've, 50% of the Navy's total budget for shipbuilding is in submarines. So this is just one of, this announcement will just be one of several announcements that we'll see around around Electric Boat and around the submarine shipbuilding industry here in Connecticut and also in Rhode Island. We are a generation ahead of our adversaries as it relates to our submarine technology, and it's one of those things that gives the United States its edge from a military perspective. It helps us keep peace in the world. By having this military strength down at Electric Boat and all of the, you know, all of the companies within Connecticut that work in the submarine supply chain. Electric Boat has, you know, upwards of 375 suppliers here in Connecticut that are working with them to help help build these submarines. So this announcement you'll see from Electric Boat, you know, the president of Electric Boat, Kevin Graney, says the workforce he needs to work on the submarines he has in backlog has not been born yet. So we're going to have great news coming out of the side of defense sector here in Connecticut for the next generation.
I'm so excited to hear about that. And again, we have Paul Lavoie here, and Paul is the chief manufacturing officer here in Connecticut, the second that Connecticut has ever had, but the only chief manufacturing officer in the country. Is that still true, Paul? I think that's amazing.
Yeah, Melissa, that is still true. Connecticut is the only state that has prioritized and made a significant investment in manufacturing. Now, we have three things that make us unique. We have the chief manufacturing officer position. Connecticut was the first state to create a bipartisan manufacturing caucus. And there are only six states that have a bipartisan manufacturing caucus. This is both sides of the aisle that come together on a regular basis to support the manufacturing sector. And we're the only state, too, that has a reoccurring investment fund that we use to invest in manufacturing. Since 2015, we've invested over $100 million in small to medium-sized manufacturing companies to help them grow and thrive here in Connecticut. You know, we have 4,368 manufacturers, and as I like to say, that means I have 4,368 customers that I need to take really, really good care of.
I love that. I think that's so fun. And something else, too, I want to, of course, get to the governor's announcement that was made about a week ago in a minute, because I want to talk a little bit about the sort of the smart manufacturing technologies that's sort of coming down Connecticut's supply chain, which is a big deal. But I want to know more about that because I don't know. But I first want to talk to you, Paul, about stigma. I think when people hear manufacturing, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I could be behind on the news a little bit, is there still an archaic view of manufacturing? Like when you host these huge career fairs where you're focusing on manufacturing jobs available to people in Connecticut, would you say one of the common concerns people have is that I don't want to work in some dingy factory with really bad conditions and all of that? Like, is that still an image in people's minds, or are people starting to realize that that is so far in the past?
No, it's still a really big issue. You know what? We did some things, you know, in the last generation that really, I think, have kind of set manufacturing back. In that, you know, we've taken a look at, you know, this country was built on manufacturing, and when you look at everything that you touch, was manufactured by somebody. I mean, the equipment that you're using, Melissa, the equipment that I'm using to have this conversation was manufactured by somebody. Mm-hmm. And manufacturing is the most noble profession that we have, because without making things, we have nothing. But yet for a generation, we basically told our kids that that's not what you want to do for a living. And we need to change the hearts and minds, because manufacturing is no longer dark, dirty, and dangerous. Manufacturing is lean. It's clean. There are a lot of green technologies that are there, but it's really moving into an area where we need to have a skilled labor force. And we do. Connecticut has one of the most advanced manufacturing labor forces in the country. And we have work that comes into here just because we have a really smart labor force. But we're making significant inroads to change the hearts and minds of kids, to change the hearts and minds of guidance counselors, educators. You know, my last big frontier is I need to get to the kitchen table. I need to be able to get information where kids and parents are having discussions about careers, where parents can understand that, you know, the average salary of a manufacturing worker in the state of Connecticut is $105,000 a year. You don't start at $105,000 a year. You start lower, but this is the kind of opportunity. We provide generational changing career opportunities for everybody within the manufacturing sector. And with the open jobs that we have a huge tent, our arms are open wide, and we have the best workforce development infrastructure in the state. If anybody is really interested in a career, a life-changing career in manufacturing, we have all the resources to get you trained and to get you into that sector. So you're spot on. One of my big challenges is, how do I change the hearts and minds about manufacturing in Connecticut, and how do I get to the kitchen table?
It's National Manufacturing Day, which means that, of course, we have our own chief manufacturing officer here in Connecticut on, the only chief manufacturing officer in the country, might I add. Paul Lavoie is back. So, Paul, let's talk about what kinds of jobs you can get under the manufacturing umbrella. Are you just working with machinery? Or, I mean, what kind of roles can people have, or careers can they have in manufacturing that they may not realize falls under your industry?
Melissa, that's a great question. You know, the great thing about manufacturing is that we employ everybody and everything. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we certainly have a need for production workers. There are production supervisor jobs, right? We actually need to make the parts, but we need engineers, and we need to have people that are designing parts. You know, I was at a company yesterday. They have a whole separate design department, and then they have a whole separate engineering department. And they're really just, you know, around how do we design parts? We have companies out there that make their own machines to be able to make the parts. And these are automated machines. And then we have all the way up to PhDs in the manufacturing sector who are working on solving complex problems in that sector. But we also need accounting people. We need salespeople. We need we need human resource people. I've talked to so many people who they're not working on the production floor, but they're working in manufacturing, and they call it they wish they found manufacturing sooner, and it's the best environment because we make things. I mean, you can get up from your desk, go out on the shop floor, and you can actually see things being made. And
so
you
cool.
know that, and you know they're going to something really important, right? Well, this is going in a submarine. Now, this is a part that we make that goes on a medical device that saves lives. And those are, you know, these are mission-driven kind of organizations
right.
that are sit there and say, we're doing things that are saving lives, for example, in the medical device area, protecting the country. You know, it really is a very large spectrum. One of my favorite things is to go out on a shop floor and to watch a high school educated machine operator who's been operating that machine for a long time and have an engineer come over with a drawing and hand it, you know, this is a degreed engineer, and hand that drawing to this production worker and say, this is our new part. And the production worker looks at it and says, well, you're not making this part on this machine, you know.
And wow, so, you know,
who's the smartest person in that conversation,
oh,
right?
Gosh.
And then the engineer
That's
says,
amazing.
Why not? And he says, because, well, this is what's wrong with your drawing, all right? This, you know, this here, this here, this here, this here. And
it.
The engineer kind of tucks their tail and goes back, and because, you know, that person operating the machine knows what can be made.
Wow.
And so it's really is a wide spectrum of people, but everybody on that shop floor is equally as important. And it's just a great way to grow a career and at the end of the day, be able to come home and say, wow, you know, I did something meaningful today.
Yeah, I agree. And I do love that idea of, like, you don't have to just be some math or science whiz. You can be creative. You can be great with sales, like you said. You can be great with collaboration. Like, that creative brain is a huge aspect of the manufacturing industry, which I don't think a lot of people realize that, Paul. Going back to your question of how do I get to the kitchen table? How do I inform people more? I'm curious because I know the state cares a lot about this. I know the governor loves you and he loves this industry and the fact that we are pushing to get more people into manufacturing. Do we go back to old school ways of teaching about careers? I mean, look, your son and I are the same age. We grew up in the 90s. I mean, we had people coming in elementary school doing not career fairs so much because, again, career fairs, you have to take it upon yourself to go to a career fair. Your parents have to or you have to. But what about inserting it into the schools, like even in elementary school, having career days again, or having presentations done where you come, you know, once every couple of years or something. I know that some schools will still do like a career day once every few years to make sure kids at some point get to see all the different options out there. But like, is that being utilized right now in Connecticut?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're doing everything we can. We're doing things like the Office of Manufacturing at the state sponsors a career roadshow, and we do that with our partners ReadyCT, who helps us with K-12 programming. And a career roadshow is simply we bring in manufacturers and they bring in interactive displays and exhibits, and
Love
then
it.
We bring kids in from the local high schools and middle schools, and so they get to build parts, they get to talk to people who work in manufacturing, they get to see what's being done, and we've done five of those this year. We did one at Housatonic, which was great. We've done five this year, and we've reached over 6,500 kids across the state. I was just out in Norwich. Norwich last week, where we did one, which was absolutely amazing. I actually made paper while I was out there. We had
well,
a
look
paper
at you,
company
Paul.
Out there.
Wow,
I
that's
know
cool.
I made some paper. Look at me, right?
I love it.
And but you know, the thing is we're getting the students and we're getting to the educators. But you know, I haven't quite figured out yet how I'm going to get to the parents, right? How I'm going to be able to show the parents. You know, one of the things I'm doing as well is I'm in our next round of funding for the Manufacturing Innovation Fund, we're going to fund the first robotics program across the state from K-12. So I can get kids interested in STEM careers, interested in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics careers, and even arts careers. I mean, there's a little bit of art in manufacturing. And if I do that and have kids come home and they're enthusiastic about it, I know when my kids were growing up, when they come home and they were excited about something, I got excited about it
mm-hmm.
because I wanted to be able to support what they were excited about. So it's going to take us a while. I mean, this is, you know, it took us a generation to get here of mm-hmm. telling kids that going to work in the trades or going to work in manufacturing isn't great. So it's going to take us a while to get there. And, you know, there's a path for everybody. So you don't have to go from high school to college. You can go from high school to the workforce and then go to college at night and get a degree or go to college and be able to learn. Because, you know, I did a commencement address at Quinnipiac and I told the students, I said, congratulations. I said, you've graduated from college. Your education starts tomorrow. when you go to work.
I mean, I wasn't going to knock it, Paul, because I don't ever want my parents to think I'm ungrateful. I'm so grateful for the fact that they gave me a 4-year education at college, and I very much value it. I got a lot out of it and everything. But I say all the time that I think even that stigma has to be broken. The idea of if you don't go to college, you're a loser. That's so not the case anymore. Or when people take gap years, that they are unmotivated. And I just think that that stigma has to go as well. There are plenty of other options than to go to a 4-year college, per se, especially if you want to do night classes, like you said, sure. If you want to continue your education, sure. But I think even that mindset, because again, that comes from a generation before, it's an honor to go to college. Yes, it is, but it doesn't mean it's the path for everybody, because do you know how many people are in debt right now paying for college and they don't even use their degrees? It's outrageous. Like, it's crazy to me. So that stigma has to be broken. That doesn't fall on you, though. But that stigma has to go, too.
Yeah, but you know, as a leader in the state of Connecticut and you know, as part of the governor's office, it is part of my job. Part of my job is to be able to convince everybody that everybody has a path to success.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that path? And the path for you and the path for me may be very different. And really, you have to understand is you know, what is that person's path for success to going to be? And in that path to success is education. There's education, and how do you define education? Is it a 4-year degree? In some industries, that's an absolute requirement.
You can't be a doctor, teacher. No, that's true. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I was going to say you can't be an engineer without a 4-year degree, but that's not true. We have engineers all across the manufacturing sector that have learned on the job and are, you know, well-trained engineers, but they received their education on the job.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to look at what's, you know, look at the individual and say, what is going to be the best path for them? You know, listen, some kids have financial problems, right? So they can go to work, make a little money, and then go. They have to support their family. But then they can also, you know, there's opportunities for on-the-job training, but there's also opportunities to go back to school either at night or online. You know, education has significantly changed since COVID. You know, I was talking to somebody yesterday who said he finished his degree at the University of Southern Mississippi. And he works in Mystic, Connecticut. I'm like, okay, you didn't go to Mississippi. You did it online. And he's like, yeah. So
there's options.
There's so many options available. And, you know, education is critically important, no matter what job you have, but certainly in manufacturing because it's changing so rapidly.
Yeah, and where you get that education, it's not all the same answer. And, Paul, I just want to thank you so much for coming on constantly to also talk about this with our audience, because that's certainly a way we could promote it as well, is by using our platform to inform the public and correct maybe some wrongs from the past, and also just to keep people updated on how the manufacturing industry continues to change and expand and really offer such potential for people. So I thank you so much for the work that you do, and thanks for taking the time to come on. Happy National Manufacturing Day, like a Merry Christmas to you, and I'll talk to you soon.
Well, thank you, Melissa. And if anybody's interested, manufacturing.ct.gov.
Absolutely.
That's our website, manufacturing.ct.gov. Feel free to reach out. And we're here to support manufacturing and careers in manufacturing. And Melissa, thank you for the opportunity and happy Manufacturing Day.
Anytime. Thank you. You too, Paul. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And a recent study, which was published in JAMA Network, showed the number of women under 50 with cancer increased from 2010 to 2019, and researchers discovered that breast cancers made up the majority of early cancer cases in 2019. And we really discovered that women need to get screened as early as possible. The annual screenings are usually at 40 years old. So to talk more about this, we wanted to have back on the show with us Dr. Susan Bulbal, who's here, who is the system chief of breast surgical oncology and breast program at New Vance Health. And New Vance Health oversees several hospitals, including some in Connecticut, like Norwalk Hospital and Danbury Hospital. So, Dr. Bulbal, welcome. So glad to have you back on the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me again and for spreading the word about early detection.
Yeah,
we greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always appreciate that you come on each and every year to talk about this, because it's a really important topic. And I certainly appreciate the work that you do. First of all, why do you think we're seeing more women with breast cancer? Why do you think the numbers are going up?
So this is a very interesting study that was done. And it really looked back from 2010 to 2019. So we cannot even blame COVID for it. Mm-hmm. But what it found was that we were seeing cancers younger and younger. And in this study, what they defined as young was less than 50 years old. Mm-hmm. So that's really the definition. And it wasn't just breast cancer. I mean, breast cancer for sure, but it was also multiple other cancers, including colon cancer. So you may be aware of that recently, the recommendation for screening colonoscopies was changed. It used to be 50 years old, and now it's recommended to start at 45. And it's all because of this trend. Now, the big question is, why is this happening? Mm-hmm. And that we don't know yet. So first rule is figure out what's happening, and then we can start to figure out why. But if we don't know it's happening, we can't even begin to start figuring out why. So this really is the first step.
Do you have any ideas, though? I don't want to, like, obviously have you, like, make an assumption, but, I mean, do we think that it is environmental? Do we think it's, like, what could be the cause of that?
So the interesting thing about so many of these cancers, especially breast cancer, is there is rarely one specific cause.
Mm-hmm.
So
true.
Even when someone has a genetic mutation, meaning they're born with something in their genes or their DNA that predisposes them to developing breast cancer, 100% of people with a genetic mutation that increases the risk of developing breast cancer do not develop breast cancer. So there's always another reason. So in general, with breast cancer, for average risk women, it's multifactorial. So is environmental part of it? Sure, environmental is part of it. Obesity is part of it. Alcohol intake is part of it. Lifestyle is part of it. So there are so many reasons. It is rarely one reason where we can say this is it.
When you say lifestyle, what do you mean by that, Dr. Bulbaugh? When you say lifestyle could play a factor in that, like, what does that mean?
So there are three what we call modifiable risk factors, meaning things that we can control in our life or change. So one of them is our weight, because being overweight increases our risk of developing breast cancer. Another is exercise. I mean, unfortunately, in the United States, where, you know, an overweight society, we're somewhat sedentary. So exercise decreases the risk of developing breast cancer. And unfortunately, alcohol intake or drinking alcohol, any type of alcohol, increases your risk of breast cancer. So those are what I mean when I say lifestyle. Those are three things that are actually in each of our individual control.
I think that's so interesting, and I probably sound very elementary asking you this question, Dr. Bulbaugh, but why would any of those factors increase your risk? So like weight, for example, is it because you have a higher risk of getting tumors or something? Like why would weight or things like that play a factor in having a better chance of getting breast cancer?
So not an elementary question at all. And in fact, a great question. And it's something I discuss in my office with patients every day. And again, it's multifactorial. So if we're talking about being overweight after a woman goes into menopause, it's because of, well, one of the reasons is because of hormones. So when we are premenopausal or still getting our period, the primary producer of hormones, especially estrogen, is our ovaries. But after menopause, our ovaries are no longer producing estrogen. But it doesn't mean our estrogen levels go down to zero. So their estrogen is produced in other areas, primarily adipose tissue, which is fatty tissue. Mm. So the more adipose tissue we have, the more hormones we have. And after menopause, our breast tissue does not like hormones, which is why taking hormone replacement after menopause is a risk factor for breast cancer or can increase your risk of breast cancer.
Oh,
so the more adipose tissue we have, the more hormones we have, it increases our risk. And it's also because in adipose tissue comes along inflammatory cells. And there definitely is a correlation between inflammation and cancer, especially breast cancer and other types of cancer. So that's why weight matters.
Okay, that makes sense. That actually makes a lot of sense. And then obviously exercise.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, that
we like when things make sense.
Well, I like the breakdown because you know, and I'm not saying you, but a lot of times you'll hear doctors say the same things: don't drink alcohol, make sure your weight is low, and exercise. But like a lot of times, maybe it seems like it's common knowledge, but I think to myself, well, how does this even correlate with cancer? Like, I've always wondered that, but that makes a lot of sense when you put
right,
it that
so
way.
So you raise a great point. And I try to treat patients or the way that I think. So if I understand the why, I'm much more likely to follow a recommendation
exactly.
or advice. So I do find when someone says to me, oh, being overweight increases the risk of breast cancer. Well, okay. Well, maybe I'm okay thinking I'm overweight. It's the why. So if we understand the why, we are more likely to follow advice. And I think that it's really important for physicians and those of us in healthcare or just in general to be explaining the why. I mean, if you have kids, we used to always say, oh, because I'm your mom and I said so. Well, you know, it's nice to explain it to them and explain why something's dangerous or why they shouldn't be doing something, because they are more likely to follow it. And the same thing as adults. We do like to know the whys.
We have with us Dr. Susan Bulbal, who is the System Chief of Breast Surgical Oncology and Breast Program at New Vance Health. New Vance Health, which oversees hospitals like Norwalk Hospital in our listening area. And we have Dr. Bulbal on every year for October because it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And Dr. Bulbal, we know that the recommended age to start getting your annual screening mammograms is 40. Why 40? Did the age change? I felt like it used to be older.
So historically, it has been 40 years old.
Oh, okay.
Several years ago, at about 2016, the U.S. task force raised that age to 50, and it was highly controversial. And most of the other groups, American College of Radiology, American College of Gynecology, American Society of Breast Surgeons, kept that age at 40 and every year, and really thought that made a difference because every study shows that early detection saves lives. And just this past year, the U.S. task force has put out a new draft, so it's out for public comment, changing that age back to 40 years old because they realize that they were missing a large number of cancers. And I think, I could be wrong, but that change happened in about 2015, 2016. So it's taken this long for them to realize that they were wrong, that it really should be 40 years old because, and the numbers showed that cancers were being diagnosed and they were just being missed. And those women were coming in with cancers that they could pick up on exam, meaning they felt it or their physician felt it. That's not how we want to diagnose a cancer because it's obviously larger at that point.
Right. Well, and when you look at, again, going back to that recent study in the JAMA Network, women under 50 with cancer increasing from 2010 to 2019, boom. I mean, 2016 to 2019, it was 50. So you lost out on those 10 years where people could have been getting screened.
And it's a big deal because the task force at that time not only said 50, but they said every other year and not even every year. So we really think that it did a lot of damage. The recommendations are really starting at 40 years old and every year, not every other year, but every year to get a mammogram. And if you have dense breasts, to get a mammogram and an ultrasound. And those are pretty well accepted in the cancer world.
Is it still recommended, Dr. Bulbal, that when you're like a teenager and you go to your pediatrician or I guess it would be your gynecologist, I can't even remember when I started getting recommended to do this, but they have you do your own examinations like in the shower and stuff. Do they still do that at like when like you're a teenager? Do they still recommend that for young women?
Yeah, I don't think it's that young, but certainly in your 20s, because the reality is the only way to know if something's abnormal or new is to know what your norm is. So we certainly discuss it. We think it's a good idea to become familiar with, because everyone's breasts feel different. And it depends also on what time in your cycle that you're doing a breast exam. So try to do it at the same time in your cycle. Usually the end of your cycle is the easiest time to do a self-breast exam. And that way you know what your norm is. And that's really the purpose of it.
Okay. I have a couple. I don't know if they're myths or not, but they're still ones that I
love these.
Okay, great. Excellent. So
it's like truth or dare.
Right?
I love this
game. I have things that I've heard since I was a kid. And again, not from like adults. It was from kids at school. So, I mean, that alone should be enough. But then you'd hear it from even like high school girls or like college girls. And you're like, oh, who told you that? You know, so I'm just curious. And I've never checked on it, but I'm like, you know what? I'm going to ask. So first of all, are you more at risk if you're bigger breasted versus if you're smaller?
No, you are not. But
so size doesn't matter.
This size does not matter with breast cancer. It's equal opportunity. So people think this all the time, though. They come in and say, oh, how could I get breast cancer? I don't have breasts. I have like a size A cup. Well, it doesn't matter as long as you have breast tissue. And that's why men can get breast cancer. Because they also have breast tissue.
Okay, that's a really good point. All right, well, that's good. The other one is that bras can cause breast cancer. Any truth to that?
No, and when we really think about this, a bra is external, right? So it's sitting on top of our skin. Breast tissue is internal. It's underneath the skin. So the two don't match up. So wearing an underwire bra does not have anything to do with the risk of breast cancer.
Can it cause damage, though? Like, can it cause any sort of damage? Because there's so much controversy, I find, over...
Not at all.
Nothing.
Nothing, nothing, nothing. If someone likes wearing an underwire bra, keep wearing it. If you don't like an underwire bra, don't wear it. Does not matter.
Okay. All right. Those are really the two that I feel like I have
That's
wanted
it?
To know.
Well, oh, since wait, I, another one.
Yeah, tell me another one. What do you hear?
One
yeah.
is deodorant.
Oh, actually,
deodorant.
Yes. Wait,
aluminum.
I'm going through this right now. Yes, wait. The aluminum. Yes. Thank you for addressing this because please.
So I was in a gym and there was a big sign in the locker room. Do not wear aluminum deodorant. It causes breast cancer, signed by the management. And I could not help myself. Of course, I got dressed first and then went out. I was like, who's the management?
I love that you add that part. Of course, I got dressed and then I went out there. Yeah.
Well, sometimes, you know, you get so hyped up, you forget basic things.
Girlfriend,
right?
I know. Yeah, story of my life. We're not going to get into it, but go on. So you run out
to
the manager.
We won't go there. Went out to the manager. And they were like, well, they said. I said, who's they? And you're putting this up like it's fact. It completely is not fact. So whatever deodorant you are using, please keep using. It has nothing to do with breast cancer. But if you stop using it, you might not have as many friends or people who want to be around you.
Okay, that's where I'm
deodorant.
At right now, though. Okay, thank you.
Well,
Dr.
Keep
Bula,
wearing deodorant.
I do, but I wear the ones that don't have aluminum in them. This is the new thing that we've been doing in our house for the last, like, 5 months. I hate it.
If you hate it, trust me, other people around you hate it too.
Okay, that's how I feel. I have sweatshirts on and it's like 90 degrees outside and everyone's like, oh, are you cold? I'm like, yeah. And I'm sweating, but I'm like, nope, I just don't want you to smell me. That makes me feel so much better. I am going
Go
to the
back
pharmacy.
To whatever
after...
deodorant works for you.
So, but then I don't understand them. What's the big deal with like even men like not wanting to wear with the aluminum? What's the thing with the aluminum? That like started, I feel like, 10 years ago and has been a growing thing. What is that?
Right. It's one of those things that they is in quotations because we never know who they is. It's like a rumor.
So just some jerk made up that rumor and made it go viral? Great.
Well, it may be the companies that make the deodorants without aluminum made it
out.
Who knows? It's great marketing.
I don't appreciate
it. Did it. Kudos to them because it's great marketing and lots of people have stopped wearing deodorant altogether or deodorants with aluminum. But it does not affect your risk.
Well, I'm so glad that you kept talking because I was going to be done after the two questions, but that's the one that actually has been burning at me all summer long. So thank you. Thank you for that and all of
my
this.
My pleasure.
Oh, man. Dr. Bulbul, thank you for the work that you do and for taking the time to come on WACC. I really appreciate it.
And thank you. We greatly appreciate getting the word out any way we can.
Absolutely. And again, Dr. Bulbul is the System Chief of Breast Surgical Oncology and Breast Program at New Vance Health right here on WACC. We want to welcome back to the show Senator Ryan Fazio. Hey, Senator Fazio, how are you?
I'm great, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. And for those who don't know, State Senator Ryan Fazio is the ranking Republican member of the Energy Committee here in Connecticut. And what huge news earlier this week. I couldn't wait to get you on the show when we found out that Avangrid was pulling out of the Park City Wind deal. What was your reaction?
Well, obviously, it's a negative development for Connecticut, but I wasn't surprised. We kind of had the expectation that this might be coming for a long time now. First of all, despite the fact that we contracted this energy, this electricity, over 20 years at a rate that was at least double what the market rate for electricity is, it was still lower than what most offshore wind deals were being renegotiated to. Secondarily, when we negotiated this deal as a state government, we only, despite it being a multi-billion dollar electricity deal, the cancellation fee for the deal for Avangrid was just $16 million. So we were severely underpricing the risk and the optionality that we were giving Avangrid. So it was essentially a heads they win, tails we lose as a state type of contract. And when it turned out that the cost of doing business was higher than when the deal was inked, they just pulled out of the deal and they're going to rebid and hope that they get, instead of $80 per megawatt hour is how you price electricity, they're expecting probably $130, $140. And again, this is compared to the market rate for electricity of $30 or $40 or $50. So eventually, that means consumers in Connecticut are going to be paying far more for no electricity.
Okay, so let me, I want to make sure I don't put words in your mouth. Were you saying that this former deal that included Avangrid was a bad deal, or are you saying overall the idea of offshore wind is a bad deal, like a bad project, or both?
I would say that most of these offshore wind deals are bad deals that are getting worse.
So again, you're saying they're bad deals, like with these companies, like, but is the concept of offshore wind a good idea? It's just not being executed correctly.
Listen, I would say that wind power is a necessary part of our future energy portfolio. We should do what works. We should do what is relatively clean, relatively affordable, and relatively reliable. And it just looks like we're at a stage where offshore wind is going to be three or four times as expensive as the general market for electricity, and yet the northeastern states still seem to be wanting to sign the contracts, which means that when the projects get built, and they haven't been built yet, that the consumers are paying a lot more for electricity. And so as is, I don't think these offshore wind deals are good ideas, because I just cannot justify in my head forcing Connecticut residents who are suffering from a much too high cost of living and much too high electricity bills already, see new electricity at prices that are three times or four times as expensive as before.
I mean, it's a similar concern that people have with going electric with vehicles. And again, we have Senator Ryan Fazio here. We're talking about the offshore wind energy and the projects that, well, right now we're sort of back to square one with the Park City Wind Project in Bridgeport, because Avangrid earlier this week said, I'm out. But we also know this week, as Senator Fazio kind of hinted at, the governor decided to go in with Massachusetts and Rhode Island signing a document that basically they're going to do what they can to find any opportunities for offshore wind projects that will benefit the whole region. But back to the comparison of going electric with vehicles, Senator Fazio, this was a direct question I've asked the governor many times on my show before, which is that these are expensive vehicles. We're expecting people to just bail on their gas-powered vehicles. I know that, you know, we all want to save the planet. I would hope that people don't want the planet to perish because then we'd all perish. But, you know, to what end? Because, like, how clean really is it? And how expensive is this going to get? And is this really plausible? I think those are some big things where, like you said, Connecticut residents are already spending insane amounts of money for so much. So to now spend more to maybe get something back for our environment, I don't know if there's enough there for people to support it. But, again, it just seems like both sides don't see eye to eye on this one.
Listen, so again, and just to reiterate, there is a regulation that's been proposed by the administration in the state to ban the sale of gasoline-powered cars by 2035. That follows the lead of California and several other states. Now, one problem, as you say, is that electric vehicles cost thousands and thousands of dollars more upfront for very similar vehicles. Generally speaking, I think electric vehicles are good, and I want to see a proliferation of more electric vehicles. And I think there's some policy reforms that can make it a little bit easier to buy an electric vehicle in the state, and I'm for them. I'm rooting for it. But I also don't think you can force a round peg into a square hole. And I think that personal choice and personal freedom and market competition is a better means to achieving these ends and more reasonable for Connecticut residents who, again, suffer from a very high cost of living already, partially because we overregulate people and overtax people. But now we're adding insult to injury because we're going to impose a very burdensome mandate on them. And the problem with regard to the electricity grid is that we just learned that we might not be able to generate as much new energy because of these offshore wind contracts being canceled by the developers. And we're still, and that means, but at the same time, we're going to force new demand onto the system. My calculation is that in order to meet the demand every year for this new electric vehicle mandate in the state, that we're going to need to build one of these new Park City wind projects every single year, except this one was just canceled. But again, the numbers are that we're going to have to build a new one every single year in order to meet the equivalent of what demand we're putting on the grid. That means that we're going to have a situation in 15 years where we're adding way more demand and we're taking off, but we're not able to compensate with as much supply, which means either we're going to have shortages of electricity, which would entail things like rolling blackouts, or we're going to have way, way, way higher prices. And you'll be longing for these good old days. And I guarantee you most of your listeners think their electricity bill is too high already. So this is a very, very bad situation potentially on the horizon. And I think we need to operate from a place of practicality more than ideology. We should be trying to improve the environment while we improve affordability and while we ensure that the electric grid is reliable for the future. We can't do just all of one and none of the others. We have to be practical. And I just don't see how our current policy is that.
Well, Senator Ryan Fazio, I really appreciate you weighing in on the conversation. Like I said, definitely huge news and huge implications earlier this week when Avangrid pulled out of the Park City wind deal. And Senator Fazio is the ranking Republican member of the Energy Committee here in Connecticut. So I thank you so much for your insight on this, and I'm sure we'll get an update again really soon. Appreciate you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right. Senator Ryan Fazio here on WICC.